Hi folks, I am Alan Watt and this is Cutting Through the Matrix.
Julian Huxley had said that at the very top you have the economic giants. Beneath them you have the scientific class that runs it all beneath them, including the behaviorists and scientists who deal with the minds and the masses. These were the ones who were the specialist class who dealt with that. Then you had teachers and academia, etc., all the way down to the bottom. So many classes. Well, all the stuff that the Nazis were blamed for, and this is after Nazi Germany, by the way, because they brought eugenics back. And one of the biggest pushers of that, of course, was cleverly put through at UNESCO by Julian Huxley. They made it part of the progressive movement. They call it the progressive movement. So progressive eugenics, you see, by genetic, progressive genetic alteration. It sounds better than just eugenics, they've got a bad name, you see. So anyway, I'll put up a link to the post-war era with Huxley, of course. And you have to go through it and read about the Huxleys. Very important family, of course. And you'll find that continuity of eugenics in 20th century Britain by Professor Paul Windling, it's called. And so it's not conspiracy theory at all. He talks about the life and ideas of Julian Sorrell Huxley. Represented not only considerable contributions to evolutionary theory, but also to eugenic thought and social planning. So it's not conspiracy. His career and his history was complex and disjointed, making him an international, very much a public figure. And it goes into how really the Huxleys are awfully important and how they were descended from Thomas Huxley, the Darwin's bulldog. And you find, too, they're all intermarried. All these families are intermarried. And getting back again, before I go any further, actually, it says here, an influential analysis of human evolution and set of persuasively appealing concepts for both the wider public and scientific elite. They want you to go along with it, you see. An appealing concept. Well, it's not that bad, is it? You know, see? Getting back to Winston, huh? I really want to see it, you know, what you're telling me are up there, how many fingers are up there. And I really want to see it, you see. And so you must be broken and come with them with perfect servitude. As Aldous Huxley mentioned, how the public will come along to this new agenda, which they're floating right through right now, with perfect servitude. They'll come to love their servitude. It's all the same agenda. It's almost like coding of the language, just slightly different here and there. The insiders all know what it means. They know who's talking in the same language. You see? But anyway, a full-scale trigger biography of Huxley has eluded historians because of the sheer complexity of his activities. Historians of the life sciences have recognized the theoretical originality of his scientific contributions and his role in developing what he called, in 1942, the evolutionary synthesis. His popularizing of natural history and ornithology in a new guise of ethology showed his visionary ability to define a field of research. His central commitment to reform eugenics linked to social plannings has been elucidated for the pre-Second World War period, while Huxley's role in co-authoring the anti-Nazi We Europeans, because he was an author in this one, has been duly recognized. Huxley's overlooked support for refugee scientists from National Socialism, not least at London Zoo from 1935 to 1942, can be linked to his evolutionary agendas. A number of his historical initiatives opened the way for reconsidering Huxley. These include interest in the early years of UNESCO and the UNESCO Declaration on Race, elucidation of how Cold War culture was shaped by intelligence agencies, and historical reconstruction of the place of eugenics in international population policies and practices. This is not a conspiracy theory. And it goes on and on and on, but that's only one of many, actually.
Now, people have heard of the players I've talked about before in the past, the big movers and shakers, like Julian Huxley, brother of Aldous Huxley. And of course, he was the first CEO of UNESCO, big, powerful world organization to standardize education so that children across the world get a brand new and fictitious education for the new world order, basically. And he also was given various eugenics awards. He belonged to the British Eugenics Society and the American Eugenics Society. And he believed in getting rid of illnesses as simply a matter of finding the people who are carrying certain genes, you know, the inferior types, and preventing them from being born. And he got all kinds of awards from the Margaret Sanger Foundation for birth control, meaning abortions, to help the poor across the world and stuff like that. And on it goes. Anyway, they changed their name, you see, a couple of times, and I'll put that down tonight in links for you. And I'll give you the website of what they're called today. And I've mentioned this one before a couple of years back. It's called the Galton Institute. The Galton. It sounds better, eh? Charles Galton Darwin and all these guys. It sounds better just the Galton Institute without saying eugenics. And that tells you what they're really into and what they do. And they've got a newsletter out. You can order it. You can see it for yourself, what they're up to. News and events. And they also go into the Darwin lectures. Now, what are the Darwin lectures? The cytogenetics of sex in man, human growth and its comparative and evolutionary aspects, because they're all related, interbred with Darwin, these guys, change and control in human populations, natural selection and the concept of fitness. That's the big one for eugenics too. You see, if two particular people come together and on that chain of chromosomes that match together with the genes, if it's two dominant genes that happen to have this particular illness involved, then you might get the illness. So they should just abort you. That's what that means. Congenital malformation in man and natural selection. So congenital is inherited malformation. Again, inheritance, you see. The physiology of human adaptation. The evolution of viviparity or parity. Human adaptability, its worldwide study within the International Biological Program. The population genetics of enzymes and proteins. They're big into that stuff because, you see, that's how you alter the human being through your food and everything. Through your diets and GM stuff and all that kind of stuff. And then going to against nature, the use and misuse of birth control, then human conception, and then their vision of man. An interesting one, what their vision of man should be. Of course, perfect in every way, you know, the Superman. And then you'll see all the different people who are involved in it, very big players, of course. And you'll see the names of the lecturers down through the years, and their board of directors, and anyone who's anyone is a member of it, of course, naturally. But what you have really is a mix of Darwinism and all the other theories that came out of Darwinism to do with inferior and superior, stuff that Nietzsche would be proud of if he was still going today. And of course, this was the kind of stuff that inspired Adolf Hitler to do his stuff, and it also inspired the Soviets before Adolf came along to go into creating the new Soviet man as well. They believe they can train anyone if they're born in the proper parents. And they don't need parents to save them forever. The state would take care of them and bring them up. The Galton Institute's interesting too because it works with the University College London, you know, to get taxpayers' funding into, even though it claims it's a charity and they're heavily involved with all the other big societies to bring down the population of the world. And create the right kind of people, you know, not the kinds who might mate. Oh, this is like the weather stuff. It could have this, and it may produce that. It's all with these mays and coulds that they go and actually go forward with their big objectives of sterilizing people across the third world. So we're dealing with really nutcases here, but they really believe in what they're doing. And that's the unfortunate part of this world here. The ones who are nutcases and believe in what they're doing are either the far left or the far right. And the people who are balanced in the middle, unfortunately, are subject to all the laws and so on and the actions that they make us all do and put upon us, in fact. And that's the problem with this world, as I say, in which we live.
We must remember that anybody who was anybody in the early 20th century belonged to the Eugenics Society, based in London. H.G. Wells belonged to it. Julian Huxley, as I say, was a member too, naturally. And many other people, and the Darwins, all the Darwin lineage, and the Galtons too. They're all intermarried, by the way, the Darwins, the Galtons, and the Huxleys. With the Wedgwoods, because all the Darwins, for a couple of generations, and be more of them actually only interbred with the Wedgwood family. In fact, I think when Charles Darwin's wife died, she was a Wedgwood. He then married his aunt, who was a Wedgwood. And that's how, what they did for, they were trying to do a proper, literally what they call proper breeding for intelligence and genius. That hasn't gone out of fashion, by the way, because now it's done through genetic engineering and manipulation of various genes and epigenetics, etc. That's all part of modern eugenics. And there's an article here about the Galton Collection on eugenics, and it's called Racism, Eugenics, and the Domestication of Humans. Because if you think it was all about animals, when they're experimenting on animals and so on, and still doing it too with animals too, but rats or mice, let's compare them to humans. Can we train them to do this? That's all we do. If you understand how you can train all kinds of animals, what they have in common, then the idea is ultimately you can train and control all humans too, the same way. And this article here is by Subhadra Das. And it says, the Grant Museum's current exhibition called The Museum of Ordinary Animals, The Boring Beast That Changed the World, explores the mundane creatures in our everyday lives. Here on the blog, we will be delving into some of the stories featured in the exhibition with the UCL researchers who helped put it together. December 1863, the scientist Francis Galton presented a paper to the Ethnological Society entitled The Domestication of Animals. Now, Ethnological Society, remember, for ethnic groups, for people. The Domestication of Animals. In it, he outlined six characteristics necessary for an animal to be domesticated. Now, this is awfully, awfully important because it's human traits that then can be exploited, just like everyone's got their programs on the internet, everyone's into their favorite particular social media, etc., and their Facebooks, etc., 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 right? So the first one was hardiness, the ability to survive despite human neglect. So hardiness is one. So in other words, cheap to keep alive, basically, or even cost negligible. Two, fondness for man, notwithstanding occasional hard usage and frequent neglects. Okay? Now, fondness for man, we're all social creatures, you see. We act as big groups. It's easy to manage us for that reason. Appeal to the group. And as I said here, notwithstanding occasional hard usage and frequent neglects. So they can use you for all kinds of nasty, hard, soul-destroying and physically destroying projects in the past. Big wars and all that. And then frequent neglect, where the authorities that are ruling you and supposed to be your kind of father figures, that's how it used to always be. Still, in some countries, it's still played up, yeah. Can neglect you once they've used you. And you'll still like them all. Desire of comfort, number three. A motive which strongly attached certain animals to human habitation. There you go. Desire of comfort. Four, usefulness to man. Awfully important. Words are awfully important. Man, okay. Usefulness to man. Number five, breeding freely. So when they need you to breed and all that, for numbers, like they always did for big wars or expansion of enterprise and colonialism, breeding freely. Number six, in other words, you don't have to stand and watch them or make somebody. Number six, easy to tend, by which large numbers of them can be controlled by a few herdsmen. Very important one. Easy to tend, by which large numbers of them can be controlled by a few herdsmen. These are the gatekeepers, of course, to give you what your memes are, what your temporary or at the moment obsession is going to be, that you're going to be angry about or you're pro or against or whatever it happens to be. You see? Big agendas. And also gregariousness is such a quality where you can all meet together and you judge how you are by bouncing ideas off your peer group, basically. It's worth noting that this paper was presented not to an audience of scientists who study animal behavior, but to ethnologists, that is, scientists who study the difference between different groups of people. That is, scientists who study the difference between different groups of people. And that Galton's main objective in outlining these traits was to demonstrate that domestication happened because certain species of animals were, by their inherent nature, domesticable. Now, don't be humans here. And it says, where a particular species does not have the traits to be brought under human control, he said, less civilized human societies, such as the reindeer herders of Lapland, are forced to live their lives to accommodate the animals in order to benefit from them. Galton gives examples from all over the world of how what he called the Rud races had successfully brought animals under their control as pets, sacred animals, and in zoos. In other words, it's easy to domesticate animals. Even savages can do it. And it says, we all know that museum catalogues lie. And it says that it's made it clear that it's a firm advocate, the writer here, for the agency of museum practitioners. No element of museum practice happens magically by itself in a vacuum. It's enacted by those of us privileged to work with collections. And it says, the week's guest blogger is called Ananda Rutherford and explores the questions through the looking glass of the Galton Collection online catalogue. One of the most controversial collections at UCL is, of course, the Galton Collection. And Francis Galton, with his notorious interest in improving humans by selective breeding or eugenics, the term he coined, is a problematic figure, and preserving a collection of artifacts associated with him for posterity and within the context of the modern university is troubling. Every element of the way in which he and his collection are presented requires careful consideration. And this article goes on about what they're really up to and creating order. That was the guise they went under. They're talking about an order of society run by professionals. By understanding how we tick, psychology, human dynamics, and again, very important, as part of it too in the early days, introduction of mandatory compulsive schooling for children, because that's where indoctrination starts. And other philosophers like Jack Z. Lull said the same thing, that if you don't get that early indoctrination, when you're very impressionable and you're not wise in the world, or the wise in the, I call it the conology, because we run, everything's run by conning us all, conology. If you don't get that early indoctrination and you grow up a little bit and you get it when you're older, you'll question what you've been taught. You can parrot it off, but you might not believe it. So the early indoctrination for the impressionable children is important, or the later indoctrination through college, etc., will not take, because you're thinking for yourself. Very important. There's nothing they don't know about the techniques and how they work. It's astonishing. It got me too. H.G. Wells, remember, is a member of the Eugenics Society. He knew all these different people. As I say, anybody who was anybody, all the socialists, were all the Fabian Society members too, for the supposed workers, etc., were eugenicists, if you didn't know that. Bernard Shaw was quite blatant about it. H.G. Wells and all the rest of them. Even, I think, Besant was a member of it too, old Annie. But then her daddy was a lord as well. So they ran the right wing and they ran the left wing. The whole idea was to give you parties. And the parties would sell the right things for the followers. And you'd vote. And that way you wouldn't have revolutions. Because you always vote the other ones out. Then you get sick of the next bunch after 4 or 5 years. And you vote them out. And then the other ones are back again, you see. So that's the con of all. And in reality, as I said tonight, the real rulers are professionally trained, and they have levels and levels and levels of them, multi-specialists, or specialist areas, I should say, of ruling us all. That's how it was done. And Julian Huxley was part of it too. That's how the world is run. So you can vote all you want. Is it going to change? People can't really figure it out, even today.
1948, the president of UNESCO, the United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization, and Fabian socialist Sir Julian Huxley calls for a radical eugenics policy in UNESCO. It was called Its Purpose and Its Philosophy. He states, thus, even though it is quite true that any radical eugenic policy of controlled human breeding will be for many years politically and psychologically impossible, it will be important for UNESCO to see that the eugenic problem is examined with the greatest care and that the public mind is informed of the issues at stake, that much that is now unthinkable may at least become thinkable. He's the same beauty, he's a beauty, who advocated the fact that it has to get us so humanistically indoctrinated that we would start to accept that human life was not so valuable or sacred after all. And this was after all the horror of Hitler and World War II. 1948. Still running the same agenda. Because they never change.
Back to Julian Huxley. Julian Huxley, co-founder of Planned Parenthood, along with Margaret Sanger, you know, who said that children were weeds. Men should enough weeds of their own, but that doesn't matter. They're such hypocrites, aren't they? But Julian Huxley said the same thing. We're going to knock humankind off its pedestal as a superior being on the planet in order to get their agendas through. They value life and they can do with you as they wish to. Don't forget the socialists, their biggest problem they claim was there was too many peasants. That's what H.G. Wells said. Too many peasants. And the peasants have been trained to believe they're there to help them. I think that's what socialism is. There are too many peasants. The first thing I'm going to do is take down the population. Bring it down. Bring it down. And then put it into categories. Do we really need your kind here? Oh, no, let's get rid of your kind. Mm-hmm. Right down to doing studies on populations and ethnic groups, including the Celts too, by the way. And I tell you, they've been after the Celts for an awful long time. Take them down, yeah. Why? Well, they've got an allergy to tyranny, that's why. I tend to notice it more.
And here's an article too about the Observer in Britain, the newspaper. It says how the Observer brought the World Wildlife Fund into being. It's 50 years since Julian Huxley, as a writer of Aldo, the brother of Aldo, writing the plight of African animals in the Observer, inspired the creation of the World Wildlife Fund. And I'm going to put this one up here because it's got different links off it to original articles in the archive sections of the Observer that Huxley himself wrote. Remember, he was the first CEO of UNESCO. He was an ardent eugenicist. He was all for culling off all the weaker types, Mr. Huxley. And he got all the top awards for pushing abortions and this, that, and the other things. Oh, lots of nice, shiny things he stick on his mantelpiece. But here's the music coming in. I'll read this when I come back from this break. Hi, folks. I'm Alan Watt. We're cutting through the matrix, talking about Julian Huxley, Sir Julian Huxley, of course, descent of Thomas Huxley, the best pal of Charles Darwin, and this little clique here. We're all inbred, by the way, the Huxleys, Darwins, and the Wedgwoods, and the Bens, and the whole bunch of them. And so, by the way, was George Maynard Keynes from the Darwin family as well, the Huxley Darwin family. But so they're all eugenicists, a whole bunch of them, and they all ran on this scientific formula. They believed they'd have to kill off an awful lot of people to have their wonderful paradise for their birds and stuff and all their little alligators and things like that. Anyway, it says here that according to Professor Lee M. Talbot, an American ecologist and geographer who traveled with him across the Serengeti in the 60s, Julian Huxley was an enthusiastic, gracious, friendly, rather quiet but authoritative, remarkably knowledgeable but always inquiring and visionary. He was key in transforming conversation from a narrow concern to a worldwide scientifically acceptable movement. He says he was also in favor of decolonization. He was a scientist, ecologist, and a eugenicist. He knew conservation was about making a park, then putting a fence around it. It was about social and economic contexts. And it goes on and on and on, but you can actually get the links off here to read the articles that Huxley supposedly wrote for The Observer that kicked off. And then you see all the big players that moved in immediately to back him. It's all designed that way, of course, because they're all society, has an awful lot of friends, and that's what you belong to as well. He also decided, too, to give you all your values for the children to come, and the sexual liberation to be taught at school, all that stuff, so they'd end their family unit. That was all part of it. He talks about that in his own writings, if you bother to read them. This great helper of UNESCO, he made sure there'd be a standard worldwide education, and that's what you've got today. A same culture worldwide. There can only be one, once again.
From myself, Alan Ward, it's good night to me, your God or your gods go with you.